Hi, I'm Ken.
And I'm Dee.
And this is Antiques Freaks.
The podcast. The podcast.
The podcast. What antiques are we talking about this week?
We're going to talk about a little down-home folk country favorite. We're going to talk about chalkware.
Are we now?
Yeah.
What is chalkware?
So chalkware is a general term for any figure, decorative figure. Pretty much they're not allowed to be useful. That is made from plaster of Paris or sculpted gypsum, gypsum being one of the primary ingredients of plaster of Paris, and painted usually with oils or watercolors, later tempera.
Okay, so you know those places where you take your child and you take a blank statuette of a unicorn and you give it to them and they paint it in garish colors and then you take it home and act like it's art? Is that chalkware?
Yeah. I mean, yes, for all intents and purposes, it's chalkware.
Huh. I'm assuming this goes back a little further than the 1990s if we're talking about it on this podcast.
It does, but you've put your finger on a really just one of those things about chalkware, which is that it is eternal. Chalkware is eternal.
Chalkware is ceaseless.
It turns out since we discovered chalk, which, by the way, gypsum is primarily what we use for chalk, I know there is a mineral called chalk, but nobody uses it for pretty much anything anymore because it's not as cheap as gypsum. But yeah, it turns out as soon as we figured out that chalk could be turned into a slurry that could be molded, we love to give it to kids to paint ugly colors.
Yay!
In a way that defines chalkware.
Oh no.
So the actual origins of chalkware are a tiny bit murky. They aren't really attributed to a single person because it really was just once everyone figured out you could turn gypsum into a plaster of Paris slurry and it would harden, they just started doing stuff with it. But what we do know is that it can be broken up into three major periods. The 18th century, the 20th century, and the 40s through the 70s.
So mid-century.
Mid-century, yeah.
Does this mean that chalkware is also mid-century modern?
Well, here's the thing is, I didn't say mid-century because I don't consider the 40s mid-century, because they're not there yet.
Really?
Is that a hot take?
I mean...
Yeah, the number 50 was the mid-century.
I would consider it mid-century, but I also feel like historical terms post, like, 20th century get to be hotly contested.
Yeah.
Like, with the number of people who think the Victorian era continued on up to World War I.
Yeah, well...
Despite King Edward being right there.
That one's a little easier because, like, those are supposed to be named for the monarchs. So, like, you can be wrong. Like, if Queen Victoria wasn't queen, then it's not the Victorian era. Sorry. Well, for me, I don't consider the 40s mid-century because, like, neither numerically nor aesthetically, no design elements, and very little of our, like, societal structure that we associate with the 50s existed in the 40s. They really exist as their own unique turning point into the 50s, so I don't like lumping them in.
Fair enough. And yet, chalkware.
And yet, chalkware was there through it all. So, chalkware was originally pretty much used to mimic and create affordable lower and middle class versions of fine art decor that the upper class would have. Very notably, and very specifically, Staffordshire dogs and vases.
Staffordshire, again!
Staffordshire will haunt us. When you get into antiques, Staffordshire is always right behind you, breathing.
Does this mean we get murder chalkware?
No, I actually have not found any murder chalkware, although I think it's extremely likely given how chalkware ends up being used. And given the U.S.'s extremely grim tendency to hypersensationalize violence. But I haven't found any. So if you guys can find some, like, please, I want to see it so bad.
Write in. AntiquesFreaksPodcast@gmail.com.
Staffordshire is actually the first thing I learned in antiques. At a certain point, those little dogs were omnipresent in every antique store. So it tended to be what you noticed and what you'd ask about first. They have fallen out of favor in a big way, but I have a warm spot for them in my heart. And they were extremely expensive even back then. Hence why, when people realized that you could just sort of pour gypsum, you could make copies of it. And Staffordshire pieces were, for the most part, hand-painted. So, you could do that yourself, right? This is really like one of those examples of people going like, well, I could do that, and then they tried, and it didn't work.
I don't know, it sounds like it did work, because we're talking about it now.
That's true. Now that you say it that way, I feel a little bit foolish for saying it didn't work.
It seems like they've succeeded, because they've made art for our Arts and Collectibles podcast.
So the popularity of it continued to be that they would make these like copies of really expensive, like upper class decorative pieces. And then you could also do whatever you wanted with them. So you could hand paint them to tailor them to your home if you wanted. Or there were other places that were painting them up and you could just buy them and feel like you were fancy.
Just be a fancy lad, alone in your house with your gypsum.
Well, you don't have to be alone.
If you own these figurines, you are alone.
Whoa, Ken.
Sorry. Sorry. Am I wrong?
Yes, you're wrong. I think I have a couple of pieces. Harsh. Ken's coming in with the chalkware judgment.
Okay, in like the last 6 months, have we had an episode topic that I haven't been deeply judgmental about?
No, but that's why we all love you.
Oh, thank you.
You say what everyone's afraid to say. So, chalkware really hits its stride when it gets to America. And it takes off in America for pretty much just one reason. Take how expensive fine decoratives were in Europe, and then factor in that to get them in America, they had to be exported. Because for a very long time, we didn't have these kinds of things operating in America. We didn't have fine art. We were just trying to not die and doing a miserable job of that.
I mean, you know.
But gypsum at Plaster of Paris was easy and cheap and could be molded en masse, like, a whole lot. So it became sort of like a DIY thing. You could just kind of make stuff for your house. People would repurpose, like, food molds and chocolate molds. That's probably extremely deadly if you're gonna also be eating out of them. Cool. I guess. But what I'm saying is very versatile, so people could get the knack for, like, making these decorations on their own. And you could just buy them, and they were still very cheap because they were being made in the country, they weren't being exported, and everything about them was the cheapest they could possibly be. For reasons I, and apparently nobody at all, can really figure out, it is almost synonymous with the Pennsylvania Dutch.
God damn it.
Which is to say, Germans that landed in Pennsylvania.
Why? Okay. Why do we get blamed for all of the ugly art? You know? Why? Why do we gotta be blaming the Pennsylvania Dutch for everything hideous? I feel attacked. I came to Antiques to have a good time, and I am honestly feeling so attacked right now.
Let me lessen the sting. The Pennsylvania Dutch folk art pieces are considered to be some of the finest pieces of folk art in America and are some of the most beloved pieces of chalkware. Because the Pennsylvania Dutch didn't know how to use color.
Wow. Rude. Fucking rude. Just because we have, like, a bold yet simple approach to color theory that may or may not have led one of my painting professors to believe I was colorblind.
But it's a wonderful thing.
Maybe it's not for you. Have you ever considered that?
I think Ken's uncovered how so many abstract artists get started the way they do and develop the attitudes they have, if you've ever wondered. Because for the most part, what you're, like, I think the association you're making with chalkware being ugly is what we're going to get into pretty shortly here.
Uh-huh.
The Pennsylvania Dutch folk art pieces aren't really what you're thinking of. Those are generally used with, like, kind of low quality molds, but the painting tends to be really clean and totally by hand, and the colors work. They're nice, bright, beautiful, fun colors, because Pennsylvania Dutch remembered what fun was like.
Well, certain members, but yes.
Many of them. Others not so much. Christianity will do that to any culture, unfortunately.
So, when you say Pennsylvania Dutch pieces, I'm guessing these aren't the same pieces that are being beamed into my mind directly from Savers.
They are not, no, far from. The Pennsylvania Dutch pieces are generally, like, they're on the high end of chalkware, which, of course, isn't very high end, as you might be guessing from your assumptions of chalkware, but we're talking, like, in the hundreds, which other chalkware would never approach.
Oh, well then.
Yeah, like I said, they're considered fine art folk pieces. So, no, they're not. I'm going to go ahead and absolve them from being ugly. I think that I saw some. They're very nice. Some of them even made their own molds. They helped popularize it in America, though, because they were just really good at it.
Yeah.
But nobody knows why it took to them specifically. Possibly just because the Pennsylvania Dutch are well known for their being able to excel at all kinds of handicrafts, I guess. They probably just did it better, and then now we remember them.
I mean, not owning a television does free up a lot of time, but
Well,
I think part of it is because there was already such a strong folk art tradition with, like I said, those very bold primary colors.
Yeah.
If you're listening to this podcast, one, hello, thank you, I love you. Two, go Google Pennsylvania Dutch hex signs if you want to see some cool occultish stuff that probably explains a lot about my brain today.
It's folk art and folk magic.
Woo, spooky.
So, later on, after the Pennsylvania Dutch would make chalkware a absolute sensation, it would see another resurgence. This is like the stock markets, it goes up and down. After World War II, because even though exports and imports were cheaper at the point, after World War II, everyone was pretty depressed. And the global economy... After World War II, everyone was pretty depressed and the global economy had been completely destroyed. So cheap and affordable ceramics existed and could be exported, but that wasn't happening.
No.
We weren't seeing any of it because nobody had time. And everything was really depressing because we were all coming off of all kinds of different rationings and supply limiting. So chalkware wasn't necessary for the war efforts. It was colorful, it was fun, and it was cheap. So here it comes, right, marching right back into our little decorative hearts.
Yay!
And it saw another resurgence in the 60s because, I don't know, I assume just because everyone's taste got really bad.
That's how I excuse most of the 60s, if I'm being brutally honest.
Really? Like, yeah. In my opinion, no offense, I think some of the stuff from the 50s through the 70s is some of the ugliest chalkware possible. I don't like the color orange. I think it's hard to make it work if it's not in a, like, a Halloween scene.
And Lord knows the 60s on into the 70s and early 80s was really orange's time to shine in home decor.
It really had its moment.
God, I already told you, but, like, there's a couch in my grandparents' house that has been perfectly preserved since the late 70s, early 80s, since my grandpa got a really great deal on it from his furniture shop friend. And I had always assumed he'd gotten a great deal on it because it's the most hideous thing I've ever seen. It is varying shades of brown and orange splotches in, like, pristine velvet because, Lord knows, grandpa took care of this couch. And no, it turns out Grandpa considered it a great deal because he can't believe no one had already bought this beautiful couch.
I want that couch so bad.
It's truly something to behold. It's in great shape! Great shape! Perfectly preserved. Shouldn't have been, but was.
The beautiful mystery of the couch.
We have kind of a couch situation in our family right now. My parents have, I think, 3 couches in their house that they're just kind of desperately trying to foist on other family members. Because frankly, that is too many couches for a house. Especially if all your kids moved out.
Wow. Have you considered that maybe he was colorblind and he perceived the couch as a much prettier color?
I don't think so. I think he, like me, might just be very bad at knowing what colors look good together.
All right, that's fair.
Although I will point out that even I knew that couch was ugly.
Okay, well, eventually, chalkware met its death knell outside of kitschy little paint-it-yourself therapy shops. I don't know why I called it that, but that's just how I think of them in my head.
You're not wrong, though, is the thing. That's a very accurate assessment.
I think it's because I'm an adult and I'm only familiar with them in that, like, weird upscale Silicon Valley, like, painting parties. And, like, I think for kids it's more normal, but, like, I don't live there, so.
You don't live that child life?
I don't live that raising kids life, so it's not like.
It really is just, like, paint night for kids.
Yeah, it is, but I think kids get more out of, I think paint nights are wonderful for everyone. I'm coming off as super judgy, but I think it's super fun for kids.
I really enjoyed Chris Fleming's paint night video, and I feel like, I guess I just don't understand how they became, like, a corporate model. Like, I don't know why, if you wanted to paint, you couldn't just go to Michael's and then call your friends and then put Bob Ross on the TV and have a time.
Well, you're saying that because that's what we do. I think it's, paint nights exist kind of as a way to make friends. You know, we always, like, every cyclically, every 30-year-old gets into that conversation about it. It's kind of hard to make friends at 30. this may make it a little easier. You can meet other people in around your age group that like the same thing you do, namely getting super wasted and painting. Because they're always wine. Always.
See, I was unaware that paint night was a thing you did with strangers. I thought you had to, like, get all the other wine moms together from the PTA and, like, hire the place out for the night. I didn't realize you could just show up. I would have been showing up the entire time.
Yeah, a lot of them actually do. You just kind of turn up. And you can meet people there. So I think that's kind of like where a lot of its popularity comes from. And I think wine mom's just like an excuse to drink wine and then make it seem like that's not what they were doing all night. So chalkware died in the 1970s because now cheap ceramic was easier to produce than ever. And there was also plastic alternatives for things that you wanted to make disposable. So there was literally no reason to be using plaster of Paris anymore. Now, in between all of this is one really important factor. This is my favorite thing, even, like, because I love mysteries, and I know I'm never going to unpeel this one, because, like, the American history, especially when it comes to, like, folk arts, is really hard to unpeel. Nobody can agree when this started. And everyone kind of assumes it's just, like, when carnivals started happening.
Why carnivals?
So, chalkware is probably known by a lot of people older than us younglings as a carnival prize.
Were they trying to punish people for attending the carnival?
People loved it.
Were they trying to punish them for their sins of levity and their vice in seeking earthly joys at the carnival by burdening them with this art as a reminder of their sins?
I think it was because it was cheap and easy to produce, and at that time we didn't have a method of doing that with stuffed animals yet.
No, I'm pretty sure it's a punishment.
Okay. Hey, that's fine. All right, so it was Carnival Prize's Divine Retribution.
Uh-huh.
But I'm going to give you a really watery around the 1910s, because that's when we start seeing carnivals pop up as like a thing that happens in America.
Right.
And you can find references to carnival chalk in the 1910s. But I think carnival chalk is overwhelmingly everyone's most common association with chalkware if you're not already in antiques. So you see this from the 1910s till about the 1940s when Disney decided to destroy the entire concept of a traveling fair. Very generally, but you can say this with a degree of confidence, much, much, much lower quality than everything else we're going to be looking at.
Shocker.
They reused the molds till they broke. Paint application is best described as haphazard, and for some reasons in the 1930s, they just coated them with glitter. Another thing I couldn't figure out is how it was possible to pinpoint the glitter to between the 1930s and the 1940s. All anyone knows is that pretty reliably we kind of know that that's when they did it. I don't know why. The citations are murky.
Was glitter made of different stuff during that time period?
Yes, glitter was made out of a lot of glass.
Did they stop because that was hazardous?
They did, as it happens.
Because that sounds hazardous.
Yeah.
I'm not a doctor, but I don't think you should be coating decorative objects in broken glass.
I agree. I'm glad they stopped doing that. And there was foil, too. We did have metal foil, but, like, the glitteriest glitter was made out of glass and foil.
And I feel like the metal foil, the metal was needed for other things around that time.
Yeah, that's the thing, is after, once you start creeping past the 1920s, the metal becomes more important to stuff. When I say you don't know exactly how, but you do know reliably, what I'm saying is that, like, a lot of these things are made of characters and, like, comics and, like, that are pretty specific to these decades, and they're covered in glitter.
Your Popeyes, your Little Abners, your Orphan Annies.
Your Betty Boops. Yeah, and these tended to be coated with glitter for some unknown reason. So that's why, and they only exist in this, like, little tight bundle. So we tend to assume that the other pieces that have glitter are coming from that same time period, especially considering not all time periods of Carnival Prize chalkware have glitter.
Oh, they used the glass glitter so it would cut your hands like stigmata to remind you of your vices in attending the carnival rather than going to the cathedral.
I've touched the glitter pieces and they don't cut. The thing about glass glitter is that it's crushed very fine. It's mostly dangerous to work with, to like be producing, because you can't breathe glass, turns out. Many have tried, few have succeeded.
Oh no.
A lot of people think that the very first chalkware prize was the Kewpie doll. This is not strictly true, but...
I was gonna say, I feel like it would have come up in our Kewpie doll episode if it were.
Well, it probably should have, because Kewpie dolls are possibly the best known and most common carnival chalk.
Really?
Kewpies and chalkware got really popular at about the same time. And it was so ubiquitous that for a while, and I think even to this day, some people actually refer to chalkware as Kewpie chalk.
Wow.
Carnival workers would actually just yell, step right up and win yourself a Cupie doll, regardless of what the prize was. Because when people thought Cupie doll, they immediately associated it with these Chalkware figures. I think that's neat.
Oh.
It doesn't prove anything, but it's neat.
It is neat.
Other things that you would see Chalkware pop up would be wall decor, specifically walls, including wall pockets, and that is a unique kind of facet of the Chalkware zone. Did you think I wasn't going to mention Chalk Zone? I will.
Oh god, no. Please.
Lamps, especially later, and advertising pieces. Chalkware was, at the time, everyone's answer for disposable advertisement.
Yeah?
It was extremely cheap, very easy to mold, and getting rid of it was as easy as just putting it somewhere else until it rained.
Return it to the earth.
Return to the
earth. From whence it came.
It breaks down super easily, so people probably thought of it as, like, biodegradable. And so you could get these, like, huge advertising pieces that people... It was the same as, like, the inflatable Corona bottles and, like, cardboard cutout stands for Doritos, basically.
Or cardboard cutouts of David Hasselhoff's busts, roughly 6 feet by 6 feet, that start out at the Cumberland Farms and then somehow wind up in your apartment in your shower in the morning when you're trying to get ready for work, and your roommates have no idea how it happened.
You are leaving out the fact that his eyes were drilled out and replaced with red Christmas lights.
Well, that happened later. That happened after the initial shower discovery. We didn't have Christmas lights on him in the bathroom.
No, but I wanted that to be, if we're going to talk about the hassle heist, then we're going to have to bring that up.
So before we had giant Hasselhoffs, we had Chalkware?
Chalkware Hasselhoffs. For other reasons that I couldn't quite figure out, except that decorative lamps in general were like on the upswing in the 1970s, you saw a lot of Chalkware lamps. It's one of the most collectible like areas of Chalkware. Some of the highest end. And they are so kitschy, it makes my eyes hurt.
Now that's kitsch.
I know, right?
Now that's what I call kitsch, volume 15.
Another thing about collecting Chalkware that's really exciting is that because of the nature of it being sort of like a handcraft, you get identical molds where no two are painted the same. It's all like every single piece is super rare, which I realize makes none of them rare, but it's exciting on like an emotional level.
That's true.
Now, the sloppy paint application can be extremely useful when we think about how do you reliably date Chalkware with such a long span in its history? Good luck. Best of luck. When the problem with a material that people don't stop using is that they don't stop using it, and people make Chalkware now. So that's an issue.
That's your problem right there. Your dog's made out of chalk.
Your dog's made out of chalk. Subject matter goes a really long way in helping you determine the age. For the most part, I don't think anyone is making reproductions of the Chalkware like Staffordshire pieces. Which is a shame, because they're expensive. People are really missing out here. Guys, make a lot of money. Make a reproduction.
I don't know that there's much demand apart from on this podcast right now.
And in general, like I mentioned before, you can use characters or concepts that are being displayed in the piece to kind of narrow down what time it exists in. For example, the Lone Ranger is pretty much in a tight, like, decade of popularity. And there's a lot of Chalkware Lone Ranger stuff. Or, like we mentioned, Betty Boop, we are kind of familiar with coming out of the 1930s.
Yeah.
And you can get a little more esoteric. While I was researching this, I found this extremely fascinating, almost terrifyingly specific fact. A sleeping Chalkware Santa, and Christmas Chalkware is strangely very uncommon, a sleeping Chalkware Santa is likely to be European because Santa is more commonly depicted as sleeping in European depictions of Santa Claus.
Why?
Right?
Why is this? Why have they done this?
I gotta like get some of those books on like Christmas collecting because someone's gotta have the answers to why Europe thinks that Santa's asleep.
Do they think he's just like tuckered out after all of his hard work delivering children to Krampus?
I was wondering if maybe it's just because it makes it look cozier and everybody likes to see a cozy Santa.
Maybe.
Because, like, I prefer my Santas to be cozy. Other things are, like, pieces particularly from the 18th century onwards to, like, the early 20th century. This has been said, I don't know how true it is, and I've certainly never, like, detected it myself. That's not saying it's not true. Older pieces supposedly have a pink cast to them because of, like, the content of gypsum.
Okay.
You can look at that.
Sure.
It reminds me kind of, like, sun purpled glass, maybe. And the paint. The paint is super helpful. For example, like I said, glitter is found on pieces from the 1930s. And airbrushing is introduced in the 1920s. This is where the quality really starts to degrade into what Ken is thinking of when he curses Chalkware's name. So as Chalkware becomes more popular, airbrushing allows you to churn it out faster than having people just painting things in a fun way. So you just airbrush through large swaths that need to be colored. Maybe you take a brush and boop in like pupils, whatever. And you end up getting a lot of spaces that are just kind of unpainted because it's imprecise airbrush work. So when you see that, that's 1920s or later. When it gets worse, in the 1930s, airbrushing got relegated to stencil use, meaning people weren't even hand airbrushing anymore. So you're getting less detail, less color in general, and less accuracy and greater huge swaths of unpainted space. Animals with glass eyes, and animals are a hugely, hugely overrepresented faction of chalkware, anywhere between 1935 and 1950. Other things you can check are the weight. Contemporary chalkware tends to be more bottom-heavy and heavier, in general, than genuine vintage chalkware.
Okay.
When I say moving forward, 1970s onward, people started being concerned with shit falling over. You may have noticed, from the fact that I continually reference that this stuff is made entirely out of gypsum or plaster of Paris, that it is extremely destructible. In fact, that was part of its appeal. It was disposable. It's very easy to destroy.
Yay!
So, with the modern home in mind, people were more concerned with making sure it didn't fall the fuck over. Which is why the contemporary pieces, 70s and newer, tend to be really bottom heavy and just like kind of heavier in general. Anything older is probably going to be more hollow, thinner, and absolutely no like weight disparity from top to bottom.
All right.
You can also check mold lines. Older pieces should only ever have two distinct mold lines. Starting in the 1970s onward, you start seeing multi-part molds where either the mold lines are very hard to spot or are just clearly more than two pieces. And other than that, in general, you can just keep an eye out for paint repairs. This doesn't really fall into anything specifically date-related, but I thought if you're interested in knowing chalkware repairs, they trend towards damaging pieces' value, so you might want to find it. I don't know that it's important to me, personally, if I were collecting chalkware, because it's always damaged when you get to it, because it's old and extremely destructible.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah. But if you care, two things. It's really hard to match paint colors ever, and it's extremely hard to match old paint colors, because we just do not have the minerals that made up those colors anymore. We're also probably not using the right kind of paint as the original chalkware paint, so there's always going to be a disparity in color. You can usually catch these repairs pretty quickly by just noting that there's a spot that doesn't match right. And, since plaster is exceptionally porous, it forms a really weird spot on top of everything because it'll spread. Professional paint repairing on a piece of chalkware is really an art in and of itself. It requires a lot of steps, a lot of application sanding, and sealing to prevent it from spreading in this way and have it blend in more. Most people don't bother with that because most chalkware isn't valuable enough to warrant it. So you can kind of see these like weird like Dalmatian spots that don't quite fit in. In general, I feel like this is like a hot take almost. I don't feel like condition should affect the price too much on chalkware. Or let me clarify. I think good condition can affect the price positively. I don't think bad condition should affect the price negatively. Does that make sense?
Correct, yeah.
I think with an inherently disposable material, expecting it to not have chips missing and chunks and like chipped paint and stuff is borderline insane. I think it's part of the scene when you're going to be collecting it. I think it's fair if you find a piece that doesn't have these things to say, this one is rare and it's more expensive. I don't think it's fair to say this one is less expensive because of these damages. To a point, if it's split in half or the head's off, that is going to affect value.
I mean, you know, that'll happen.
In general, I wouldn't recommend collecting chalkware for its investment value. Carnival chalk in particular tends to hover around $10 as like a average price. Again, this is because of its low quality and mass production. And I do mean mass production. There are exceptions. Unusual pieces, large pieces, large like advertising size pieces, again, because they were disposable, can be very valuable. Images of celebrities, I assume because it's fucking weird, they tend to do really well. I know Charlie McCarthy is actually up there, is like $400 for one.
I feel like the phrase, I assume because it's fucking weird, could explain a lot of collectibles.
I racked my brain for why people would want a bust of their favorite celebrity, and I realized that like there isn't a version of that that doesn't scare me.
I mean, I feel like my possession of a life-size cardboard cutout of Legolas is pretty benign.
That is different. I don't know why that's different, but it's different. Other valuable, like, genres of chalk are Disney characters, big surprise there. Body pieces, which is basically nudies.
What? Why did they make...
Yeah.
Why?
Erotic chalk art.
I need that phrase to unexist.
Erotic chalk
Stop
art.
Stop it meow.
Live hot chalk is waiting in your area.
It's not. It's Call chalk.
Yeah, there were chalk nudes.
All right.
They're worth a fair bit. Unbroken carnival banks are fairly valuable. Depending on the subject matter, they can be more or less, but in general, because the banks had to be broken to get the money out, just like you saw in cartoons. Again, this is the same rule, something that's inherently disposable, if it survives, is worth more. You also get things like Christmas pieces are fairly unusual. Certain religious pieces like creches, which I do realize falls under the Christmas clause. Pocket watch stands. For some reason, a lot of them didn't survive.
Huh.
And unusual animals. I was really surprised and delighted to find out that they made chalkware kookaburras.
Really?
Yeah, I found a person online who collects only chalkware kookaburras. And that's how I found out that they made kookaburras. And they are fairly valuable because it's a kookaburra. Why wouldn't it be?
Consider it, won't you? Thank you.
Other valuable pieces, this is getting a little later on the time scale, but like the Miller fish, Miller Studios pieces in general, if they're in good shape, but Miller Studios fish, I've seen them go for like 50 and 60 a piece. They're cool. They're pretty, I guess, for chalkware. Everyone really loves the Miller pieces. And like I said, the lamps. The lamps were frequently paired in like whimsical sets. It was very popular, was having a dude and a lady dancer. Many of them were racially insensitive.
Shocker.
Yeah, a big surprise. It was kind of like a tackier repeat of exoticism. So what you see is you get a lot of like, I'm going to put in big air quotes, African themes.
Ah.
And South American themes, big air quotes, like Polynesian, big air quotes themes. And it's all pretty bad from the point of view of someone who doesn't want to be an idiot. But they're worth a fair amount of money, so, like, I guess follow your heart.
And smash them because, as we've mentioned before, they're easily destructible?
You could. You don't have to put in much effort. I wasn't kidding when I said you could just get them wet. In particular, two companies stand out for lamps in terms of, like, value. You get Reglor, R-E-G-L-O-R, I hate that. And the Continental Art Company. Continental Art Company was interesting because all of the shades that matched their lamps were also custom made for the lamps, which I think is neat.
Oh.
Reglor is notable because they tried to sue a bunch of other companies, including Continental Art Company, for their male-female paired dancer lamps, which was taken all the way to the Supreme Court by the Steins of Reglor Company, and they won, and it did fuck all. It was a technical victory that could do nothing to legally stop the copying of their designs.
Yay!
So that's why they stick out and their lamps are expensive, I guess. Have fun!
Yay!
Why you think you could somehow copyright the idea of two human beings dancing together? Great. You can't. Good luck. As for care of chalkware, maybe you've been picking up on what I've been putting down here, but don't put water on it. The end.
Yay!
Most collectors do consider the gradual accumulation of staining as part of its charm.
I hate that phrase.
Yeah, sorry.
That's a bad phrase.
There's no other way to put it. I tried to, like, think of a way to say it that wasn't, like, gross.
But no, it's just gonna be icky. It's just gonna be icky, icky, icky.
There aren't a lot of ways to clean it.
Because of the whole no water thing.
Because of the whole water thing. Yeah, you're not even really supposed to wrap it in anything other than, like, acid-free paper. Because the plastic can, like, accrue humidity and damage it.
Oof.
So, like, you can't wash them. The best you can do is you can kind of take, like, soft bristled brushes and kind of scrub at it dry. But you are, you know, if the paint or the plaster starts coming off, you gotta stop because you're just destroying it at that point. So, dry. It wants to be dry.
So you can either let it accumulate stains or give it a dry rub?
Yes.
Hey, listen, I wasn't, like, super great on chalker at the beginning of this, and I feel like coming to the close of this episode, hate it, just for different reasons now.
I'm sorry, I was trying to make you like it. Wow, good to see. I failed so spectacularly.
I'm sure that through this episode, you have made other people listening like it.
Yeah, I did also collect some prices if you were interested in what, like, the higher end of chalkware looked like. You get a Scotty Dog bookend pair from the 1940s at $75. One of the Staffordshire Spaniels from around 1890 going for $225, which I think is super funny because that's about how much an actual Staffordshire one would run you.
That's, wow.
A bust of Ulysses S. Grant for $1,000.
Of course.
And a Carnival Snow White for $100.
Like Disney Snow White?
Disney Snow White, yeah.
Oh, wow.
We got a Porky Pig, too, from at $90. So that's just like a little cross-section of some of the stuff you can find. I did also find an entire full-sized stag head mount, like a taxidermy one, but all in chalk. That was, I think, $400.
I think I saw that at Target the other day.
That's so exciting. It's good to know some things never change. So that's the nitty gritty on chalkware.
Please.
The joke is that is the texture of plaster of Paris.
Please use any other phrase to describe it. Thank you. Thank you so much for telling me all about chalkware, Dee. It is certainly a thing that can be talked about.
It's gritty, dry, and it's staining.
I don't like
it. It's a fascinating look into folk art and material and American society.
Wow.
Sources include Valfa.com, chalkware care. That's literally like two sentences that just say, don't get it wet for the love of God. Mavcore.yale.edu, reflections on a medium, chalkware and plaster of Paris. If you're into religious history, this is a really fascinating read. Collectorsweekly.com, figurines, chalkware. Antiqueweek.com, archive article 2806. Estatesales.net, their article on chalkware. Cape May County Herald, DrLoriV.com, chalkware, and GhostStar.com, Antique Detective, episode 0606.
If you would like to suggest other episode topics or just say hello, you can email AntiquesFreaksPodcast@gmail.com or check out our Facebook group, Antiques Freaks Friends, or tag us on Tumblr, AntiquesFreaks.tumblr.com.
If you liked us talking about gritty, dry, stained products, feel free to scroll on down to wherever you're listening to this and leave us some kind of review. I have a preference for the 5 stars. I think the number 5 is great, but whatever you're feeling, leaving us a review of any stripe helps us get into other people's ears.
If you like products that are neither dry nor gritty, check out our Etsy at etsy.com/shop/antiquesfreaks for a wide variety of vintage goods and t-shirts and stickers with the podcast logo on them.
That's true. I don't sell chalkware, so it is a non-dry, non-gritty area.
We do sell vintage 1920s Egyptian revival condoms, new inbox.
We sure do.
Which I think is great.
It's very fun. What a conversation piece. That's all I gotta say.
And if you would like to listen to deleted scenes or our special podcast presentation of the Penny Dreadful Varney the Vampire, you can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/antiquesfreaks. I would like to point out that you only have to donate one entire human dollar every month to get access to our entire backlog of deleted scenes, so 2 years worth of extra material. Plus, we are now on chapter 20 of Varney the Vampire, so 20 extra podcast episodes could be yours for $1 today.
Yeah, it's well worth the price of admission, in my opinion.
I mean, I'm having a hoot reading Varney, I don't know about you.
I know, I've been having a blast. It has been amazing. It's like, please, you've got to check out the story. It's insane.
Special shout out to our current patrons for paying our hosting fees and filling our hearts with love.
So much love.
And thank you in particular for listening.
That's right. You.
Au revoir.
Goodbye.